from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, welcome everyone. If you have a chance, or if you had a chance, in the show notes, just click on the link. There's a link to a the CBS website for the television show 48 Hours. Or if you happen to be watching the TV show the other night, you would have seen the story of my next guest and her family. And, of course, the story is much bigger than just them, but they are such a huge part of it. Jeannie McDonough is here tonight to talk about her new book, Caught in the Act. And I could ramble on with my intro here and not be able to tell the story as well as she did, but I'll say this much. I've been emailing back and forth with Jeannie and other folks about having her on the show, and we were going to book her on here a while back, and then we decided to wait till now. And I happened to be watching 48 Hours the other night, and it's not too often with television shows. Of course, I'm a big crime show guy. You guys know that. I've been doing the show for so long, and I do a lot similar stuff on my program. It's not too often when I watch a show like 48 Hours that the hair on the back of my neck stands up, because it was such a compelling story. And I don't have much on the top of my head, Jeannie, kind of like your husband, but and that's a good thing. But I'll tell you what, that story is just unbelievable. We all want to protect our kids, but you guys went through something that, well, I hope no family ever has to go through again. Jeannie McDonough, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Dana. I appreciate it.
Nice to have you. Listen, let's talk a little bit about 48 Hours and the TV show. Obviously, the story needs to be told, but how often did you ever think that, or did you ever think that you would be on a national TV program like that, telling a story about something that most families should never have to go through, and thank God yours survived?
Well, to be honest with you, Dana, I would never in a million years think that I would be in the situation that I am. We're just, honestly, we are like your next-door neighbors. And what we went through July 30th, 2007, is everyone's nightmare. And honestly, my husband, Kevin, did what probably every husband, male in this nation would hope that they would be able to do when called upon. And we all survived. You know, it was 3:45 in the morning, and Kevin and I both heard a whimper come from the bedroom next to ours, where our daughter Shay was sleeping. And we got up. Kevin went before me into the room, and we saw a stranger standing over our daughter, pressing her face into a pillow, suffocating her. He was all dressed in black, had a black mask on, and it was surreal, honestly. Kevin said, "Who are you? What do you want?" The stranger did not answer. And he grabbed him by both wrists, spun him around, and threw him on the adjacent bed. Was able to get on his back and subdue him. I grabbed the knife, and seconds later, the intruder had a burst of adrenaline and stood up with my husband on his back. And Kevin threw a chokehold on him and took all of his weight, which is 160 pounds, opposed to this intruder's 240 pounds.
Right.
And, you know, threw himself backwards and landed on the floor with the intruder in front of him. It was surreal.
You know, Jeannie McDonough's here. We're talking about the recent 48 Hours program, talking about her family's ordeal, and, of course, her new book, Caught in the Act. They say, Jeannie, and I'm sure you experienced it that night, and we experienced it all our lives when it comes to traumatic situations, that things go in slow motion. what only lasts 2 or 3 minutes seems like it lasts forever. And did you experience that night?
We did. But honestly, it was only 4 minutes before the police arrived. So everything seemed like it took an eternity in the room. But honestly, it was 4 minutes before the police arrived.
Your daughter and we heard the 911 or a portion of the 911 call from that evening. When you think of, and I have 4 children, 2 daughters, 2 sons, and when you think of your kids and you think of protecting them and you think of raising them and you think of, are you doing the right thing as a parent? Well, I got to tell you, Jeannie, you and your hubby, and I don't know, you have a son too, but you did a hell of a job with that girl. She's one kick-ass kid, and you should be very, very proud of her for what she went through and how she handled herself.
Without a doubt, she has such strength, such resiliency after all of this, and has not allowed what took place in the past to affect her attitude towards the future. We're very proud of her.
Yeah. Gosh. I tell you, again, not a lot on top of the old noggin here, Jeannie, but what was on the back of my neck. And it seems like when we get to these ages, and your hubby can probably say that too, because I think we're similar age, we can't grow hair on the top of our heads anymore, but the back of our necks and our eyebrows and everything else get all bushy. But I tell you what, that story is one that I've watched it again online, and I encourage everyone that's listening live or on the podcast to check that out. Now, let's talk about this monster that's in the room. How did he get in?
You know what? Our back door was unlocked. Our back door was unlocked, and we didn't have the backlight on. Our porch was broken, so it was all dark back there. We were a prime target. It's unfortunate, and when you live in a small town, you really don't expect that people are going to walk in off the street and terrorize you. But you know what? It happens. I will attest to that fact. It happens.
I had a smile on my face when Shay was being interviewed, and she talked about how she left the back door open or something because she didn't want to get a text from her brother to have to go open it. And I thought, boy, have I been there. But when you see this and you hear that and you talk about safety and you talk about how to protect yourself and your family, it's those small things. And I know, Jeannie, you've turned into an advocate, so to speak, by writing this book and following the other families. And we're going to get deeper into the story here in a minute. About how to protect yourself and to protect your families. And if you had 3 tips to give families out there right now about how to protect your home and to try and discourage an intruder. An intruder is going to get into your house if they really want to. They'll break down the front door, but there are ways to discourage them. Tell us your top 3 picks.
My top 3 picks would be lock your doors, because I did ask the intruder, how did you get into our house? And he said, well, the back door was unlocked.
Right.
And I asked him, if the back door was not unlocked, would you have gotten in anyhow? And he said, no, I don't know how to pick locks.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely lock your doors. And if you can put motion detector lights around your property, do it, because that's key. It was very dark in our back of our back door, and, that had to do with it. And the other thing is, if you don't feel like something is right, just go with your gut, because we could have rolled over and just ignored our daughter's whimpers. I mean, she whimpered, and it was very slight. She's 15 years old. She's sleeping in the next room next to us. We could have rolled over and just ignored it and thought, oh, she's having a bad dream, not a problem. Thankfully, we didn't do that, because if we did, we would have been met with just the most horrific, horrific fight in the morning. And I pray, I say my prayers every night that we didn't do that.
Well, they work for you, that's for sure. Yeah, Jeannie McDonough is here talking about her new book, Caught in the Act. Let's talk about that monster that's, you know, we tell kids that when they go to sleep, you can't be afraid of the boogeyman, just close your eyes and everything will be all right. Well, the boogeyman got into your house that night. Let's talk about that monster. Who was he? What was he all about?
Well, he did. He got into our house that night. His name was Adam Leroy Lane, and he was a long-haul trucker, and he drove, you know, up and down the eastern seaboard coast doing deliveries, and he happened to park in the rest area right across from us, probably a mile away. And he went through neighborhoods that night just searching for people to kill, women, innocent women to kill, and he ended up at our house, and it still just floors me to this day.
It's difficult, I know, and I appreciate you coming on the show to talk about it tonight.
Oh, Dana, it's my pleasure.
You know, this Lane, obviously, and we're going to get into, he's been charged and convicted for two other murders. Serial killer, and we've talked about serial killers on the show many times. My audience knows the difference between a mass murderer and a serial killer. He goes out and he stalks and he does what he has to do to satisfy him. Looking in his truck later on, the police find a bunch of horror movies and things like that. Tell us about that.
Well, they look in his truck and they find a bunch of DVDs and other weapons, actually, that he had left behind. The DVD that was in the player at the time was a DVD called Hunting Humans.
Jeez.
Yeah. And he had left that in the DVD. Apparently he'd been watching it and then decided to just go out into the neighborhoods and search for women.
When did you find out, Jeannie, that the police were looking at this individual for a couple of other crimes, actually more than two?
Well, honestly, the next day we were brought down to the station and we learned that he was a long-haul trucker and that he had parked in the rest area on the northbound side of 495. We live on the southbound side. But it wasn't until 3.5-4 weeks later that we found out that he was suspected in killing a woman in Bloomsbury, New Jersey, Monica Massaro.
Right.
Yeah. It was a while.
I'm sure it was so surreal to see the video footage on 48 Hours in the courtroom. And you've gone to all the court hearings to see your arm around your daughter and the gauze, the bandage still around your hand. I noticed that right away from, obviously, when you grabbed the knife. When you're in these courtrooms, not only for your daughter's situation, but these other families, and by the way, your family is instrumental in bringing an innocent man, because in one case, a husband was actually arrested, and I want you to talk about that a little bit. But spending time, what made you decide, because once you knew your daughter's case had been looked after, so to speak, what made you decide to go and follow the case of Lane and work with these other families? And like I say, all the power and thanks in the world to you for saving a man from an injustice.
Thanks, Dana. I appreciate that. You know, the day that I found out that Adam Leroy Lane had killed Monica Massaro only 22 hours before he came to our house, I really didn't know how to process that information. I was beside myself. And so that night, needless to say, none of us were able to sleep after that home invasion. But that night, I went out and I just started writing and it just started pouring out of me. And I felt like I needed to write about this experience. In order for me to understand what had gone on and to just wrap my head around everything. And so I started writing. And then it just snowballed. And My husband was a huge inspiration behind the whole thing. He brought home newspaper articles, and I kept writing about everything. And I had several people read what I had written, and they said, you know, Jeannie, this is very good. I think you should do something with this. And it just snowballed into ending up into a book.
And the book is Caught in the Act, and again, go to Amazon or any of those websites to make sure and buy it. Click on the show notes, the link to see the 48 Hours interview. Jeannie McDonough is here. Jeannie, when you look at the story and you look at your life, you look at your family, and there was one moment when they were interviewing Shay, and I'm not sure when they videotaped that show, but she said, and you could see it in her eyes, again, a sharp, intelligent, beautiful young woman who went through, you know, thank God she was able to, you and your husband were there to follow your gut, your instinct, and you as a family saved yourselves from this monster. But your daughter has spent some time in therapy, and she has been able to turn things around. How is she doing today? Because this is something that you're never going to forget, obviously.
Absolutely. She's never going to forget it. And, you know, she was 15 when it happened. She's 19 now. And she, you know, honestly, she has her grandmother's spirit, her grandmother's heart. She has a resiliency that makes me proud today. She's not allowed what has happened to her to affect how she feels about people and the human spirit and the goodness of people, because honestly, the outpouring that we received as a result of our attack and our home invasion was overwhelming. All of us were deeply affected by it, and she amazes me every day. She really does. She's remarkable.
Your whole family is remarkable, and I found it touching to see the young gal, and her name slips my mind right now, the daughter of the
Nicole?
Right, and she said that she calls you, and she calls you Mom, and you end your phone calls with I love you. How important is that, Jeannie, to be able to stay connected with the other families?
It's critical, honestly, because we're here. Kevin, Shay, Brian, myself, we're all here. And, you know, Nicole lost her mother, and the Massaros lost their daughter.
Yes.
And it's something that will resonate with me for the rest of my life. And if I can, in some small way, just pay tribute to them and give them a voice, I honestly need to do that.
Was there ever any comment, response from Lane back to the families? Anything to you?
No, there's never really been a comment. Honestly, the only thing that ever gave me any sort of resolution, and I don't even think I can say that word, but was when we were in the courtroom in Pennsylvania, and he saw my husband and I sitting there. And he saw us. His eyes locked on ours. And I know, I mean, the look he gave me was one of pure hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Pure hatred. I'm sure he wished he had taken me down that night when he had the opportunity. But for me to be able to look back at him with just empowerment and say, you know what, I'm here. And you're going to prison for the rest of your life. That was extremely gratifying for me.
A case of good versus evil. Good wins, as it should. Your family, Jeannie McDonough, is top-notch. I was talking to you off-air a little bit. Wendy Murphy, who is a victim's advocate, someone in your area who is a former prosecutor and works with victims all the time. And she commented, Jeannie, on the show, saying that she saw that and she went, wow, what a strong and smart family. please tell her I send my praises. And I think everyone across North America do that, Jeannie. I ask you one last question. I'll give you the final word. When I have authors on to talk about their books, we all walk through bookstores. You do press. You do media. You do what you can to get the word out about the book. The 48 Hours episode was top-notch. But what is there about your book that will make me pick it up in the bookstore, flip through it a little bit, and take it home and read it?
Thanks for asking that, Dana. Well, what it is that we are just your neighbors. We're just people that were faced with adversity and were, by the grace of God, able to step up and face it and face it down. And isn't that what it's all about? You know, honestly, in the end, we all hope that we'll have the strength when we're called upon to have it. And my husband, who will forever be my hero, was able to protect his family at the most critical time. And honestly, we're just your neighbors. There's nothing extraordinary about our story except for the fact that it could have happened to people that live next door to you.
Yeah, and it just shows you that, you know, you as a family, you need to expect the unexpected, but even more important is to tell each other that you love each other, care for each other, and protect each other, and that's so important. Again, the book is Caught in the Act. Jeannie McDonough, click on the link in the show notes, go to Amazon, all the book links on the internet bookstores. Pick up the book. It's a fascinating story. Jeannie, thank you. I really appreciate it, and give my best to your family.
I will. Dana, thank you so much for taking the interest and taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it.
I would like to stay in touch, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
Awesome.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Jeannie McDonough, and the story, jeez, is just unbelievable. It's something you got to watch, the 48 Hours link, and they actually replay the program, so just click on the link in the show notes. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back with Wendy Murphy in a minute or two, and she's going to talk about a couple of her recent articles. I'm going to get her to comment on the McDonoughs, but one of them, if there were only book sales and compassion for all victims who tell, and you wonder what that's about, well, Wendy will show this to you. And how about, you know, the movie Conviction starring Hilary Swank, which claims that Kenneth Walters went to prison for a crime he did not commit? Well, you know, Wendy, she's got something to say about that, too. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, it's always a pleasure to have Wendy Murphy on the program. You'll know Wendy is a former sex crimes prosecutor, author, crime analyst, victims advocate, you name it, and a fan favorite here on the program. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Dana. Good to be with you again.
Nice to have you, too. Now, I want to get just a quick comment. I just interviewed Jeannie McDonough on the program, and you and I were emailing back and forth, and I mentioned to you if you'd seen the 48 Hours episode the other day, and without commenting on the case in general, how touching is it for someone who's been in the business as long as you have to see a family, first of all, go through a horrific situation like that, but yet to bond and to continue on helping others because of their own situation? Like, they were able to get a person wrongly accused of a crime freed and catch a serial killer. How crazy is that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I didn't see the whole show, but I certainly was familiar with the story enough to say, wow, as did everybody in my family. You know, I think that what's funny is, we all feel, I think, especially as parents, and certainly the mom in that story, watching her, I was just very struck by, as a mom to mom, how did she do that? And then I thought, you know, we all feel like we would protect our children no matter what, and then we don't really know how we would do when it really happens. So it's so comforting to see a strong parent literally do that which seems almost heroic in the extreme. So I loved hearing that. I loved seeing her be the kind of mom I wish I would have been, you know, had that been me. And I think that there's something special about people who take horrible situations that are really destructive to the spirit and to the soul and, you know, to the really what I want to call kind of the core of goodness that we want to believe about the world. When that takes a hit, it changes you. And people do one of two things. They become changed and they become fearful, or they become changed and they become helpful. And, you know, neither thing is necessarily, I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, you can't plan it. It just happens. And to watch somebody become transcendent about a horrible situation and become stronger as a result, it's one of the things I really admire about, in 20 years, all the victims I've worked with, one of the things I really admire about a lot of the victims that I've represented, you know, they started off in a certain life path, and something terrible happens, and the next thing you know, they're going to law school. And I can really tell you that lots of stories like that of clients I've had who changed their whole careers and became incredibly strong as a result. And that's a message I love. It's a message I love to share. I invite some of my former clients to talk to my law school class to convey, you know, how being brutalized and victimized affects you, and then how it becomes part of you, and then you use it to become stronger and then to help others. It's a gift, and I wish I could empower every victim with the capacity to use something that, you know, the perpetrator hopes is destructive, to become a source of power for themselves and for others.
Well said. Wendy Murphy is here. Yeah, it was certainly a case of good versus evil. A couple of stories I'd like to talk to you about tonight. Of course, just click on the links in the show notes. One of them, Wendy's Patriot Ledger article about Scott Brown, and I love the title, If There Were Only Book Sales and Compassion for All Victims Who Tell. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, a couple things. One is that I was taken by when Scott Brown's story came out, and, you know, he's a congressman, senator up here in Massachusetts, someone who people have revered in part because of the kind of rocket force behind his ascendancy from a state representative to a congressperson of huge power. I mean, he literally skipped through a lot of steps and is now a senator, U.S. senator, and I think people thought, "Wow, what a special man this is! He's chock full of huge power and special credentials, and I guess kind of a special way about him to have moved so quickly and to have carried himself so well." So when he reports being a victim of child sex abuse, what I was struck by was the public's reaction. That was kind of wow. There was this wow factor to it, and what I thought was, why are people so shocked? And, you know, what's with the oh my goodness reaction? Because if you do what I do, and, you know, I've been doing this work for so long, I have a sort of bias, obviously, but if you do what I do, you're never surprised to hear that a person like Scott Brown, or fill in the blank with the name of any other powerful person, seemingly rock solid, strong as a, you know, as an ox kind of person, was sexually abused as a child. Ooh. And the reason I loved writing about it, and I wrote about it and added a personal perspective, was that I really wanted people to understand that it's highly unlikely that you could encounter a person in your life and they either haven't been sexually assaulted at some point in their life or aren't close to someone who's been sexually assaulted. And that, yes, sometimes it is destructive, particularly to a child. Sexual abuse affects people differently. Some people are abused repeatedly, and they still kind of come out okay, and other people might be abused just once or twice, and literally it destroys them forever. And we have to be careful not to make judgments about people because one did better than the other in the aftermath. You have to remember that a lot of times it's the betrayal, not so much the physical trauma, but the betrayal, and which is a relationship question. Who was it that did it? Was there a trust relationship involved? How much of that was betrayal? That can be more destructive sometimes than the physical assault. But the reason I was so struck by Scott Brown's story was that people didn't seem to understand how typical it is to be both a very strong, very successful person and nevertheless have had a history of sexual abuse. So what I wrote was, you know, let's stop being so awestruck by the idea that a guy like Scott Brown might have been abused and start saying, well, you know, maybe this is true for lots of people, and what are we doing wrong that makes us still feel so shocked? So one of the arguments I made was, you know, let's not, first of all, assume that the reason he told is because he's looking to make
right.
money on a book deal. You know, we should be celebrating when anybody makes money
exactly.
writing a book revealing sexual abuse, because it wouldn't, you know, haven't we had an awful lot of money being made on the backs of children, quite literally, in terms of child sex abuse, child pornography? If people can make money doing bad things to children, isn't it kind of cool that somebody might make a few bucks reporting on the bad behavior as a victim? That, to me, seems morally obvious. And then secondly, you know, stop assuming that just because someone tells it might have come from a selfish or a political agenda. Even if that's true, you don't want to deter kids from telling. So if you raise that flag of, oh, what's your motive for telling, it suggests that you have to have a motive. And we don't want that to be part of the reality. We want people to tell with or without a motive, because telling is always better. And that was the point of my story. We need to celebrate telling, and that includes not being judgmental, even about politicians, when they do tell. Look, Scott Brown may have a political motivation, but so what?
Doesn't matter.
What I think
yeah.
we should be saying. So what? This isn't about politics. This isn't about partisanship. This is about empowering children. And they don't vote. They don't have any money. The way you empower children is to always celebrate when any person tells, because that helps all kids tell.
Absolutely. Wendy Murphy is here. You know, I go back to the, and for the life of me, I can't think of the name of the movie right now, Jodie Foster. And what we see where she's the victim, and where we see the media and how they cover stories like this. In fact, not too far from me.
The accused. You mean the accused.
The accused. That's it. So I just had a mind blank for a second.
Another Massachusetts case. Go ahead.
And when we see the stories, in fact, not too far from me now, there's a sex abuse case where a judge has issued a no custody but a probation, and in his summation said that because of how the victim was dressed.
And, in a tube top, I know.
It just makes you sick. And how long is it going to take us to finally educate the judiciary, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the cops, and the people? That this is an epidemic, and it's something that, you know, we're trying our best, but there's still the dopey judge out there or the person out there that just doesn't understand it.
Yeah, Dana, I'm not sure we're trying our best, and I will tell you this. It was really sad for me to see a Canadian judge make that kind of comment, because in the work that I do, I have to say I think of Canadian judges as more advanced in some ways than the United States judges. There's a wonderful judge there. I think she's still sitting, Madame Leroux, who sits on the Canadian Supreme Court, who has done fantastic work sort of shaking the tree and trying to get the legal system to pay attention to what's wrong still, despite all of our efforts after all these years. And she's great. I give out an article of hers to my students every year, and it's one of the things that they remember for years to come. One of the saddest things I think about the judge's comments is it makes people think those things we think about victims all the time, and we did sort of see that a little bit about Scott Brown. Why didn't he tell? You know, what's he doing in that situation? What's the woman doing in a tube top? Why is she wearing what she's wearing? You know, people have the right and the freedom as free people to wear whatever they damn well want to wear. As I know, you know, sort of notably say, whenever there's a high profile case, I don't care if the woman is doing naked cartwheels down the middle of Main Street. That's not permission for anyone to touch her. And, I'm making, obviously, hyperbole about it, but the bottom line remains that what's bad about our legal system is really bad, and it isn't about education. And I'm going to be very clear here. Judges can't be taught to rewire the biases that are deep within them, nor can juries kind of be taught to be fair. If you ask a juror or a judge if they are being fair to a victim, they're not going to say, oh, yes, let me have my self-critical awareness going on right now, and then, oh, yes, I see my bias. Nobody thinks they're biased, and you can't teach people not to be biased. It is a cultural problem so deeply rooted that I don't think teaching is the solution. And that's why I'm very critical of rape crisis centers and all these groups that want to do training of judges and training of this and training of that. it doesn't really change the problem. It doesn't fix the problem. It doesn't change people. What we need to do is start to say things like, why do you, as a man, think that you have a right to touch a person, period, based on what they wear, what they look like, what they're saying? Where do you come off with that idea? We say to people, you know, if my money is hanging out of my pocket, from the back pocket of my jeans, if I've got money hanging out, yes, that's a vulnerability. Yes, it might make a thief more likely to pick on me because I'm vulnerable with my money hanging out. But you still can't take my money. And if you do, there's no defense called, well, your money was hanging out. That's not a defense.
Exactly.
And if it's not a defense to theft that I was not as correct as I could have been in my behavior with my money, then it's not a defense to rape that I wasn't dressed in a way, that didn't send you the right signals. My dress, my attire, my outfit has nothing to do with you. That's a message we have never taught any society successfully, not Canada, not the United States, and that's something you can't really teach in a classroom with a course.
Yeah.
It's something that really is about rewiring our collective mental software that goes deeply to an historic lack of respect for women's equality.
Well said. Wendy Murphy is here. Your next op-ed, you were kind enough to send me a little note here on it. Let's talk about it. The movie Conviction, Hillary Swank, say that three times real fast, which claims that Kenneth Walters went to prison for a crime he did not commit. We're all familiar with it. It's you can't beat a good Hollywood story about a little guy who fights back against the man and wins. Let's talk about your next op-ed.
Well, that is the first line of my next op-ed, which, by the way, comes out tomorrow at patriotledger.com for folks who want to read the details. The purpose of my piece, Conviction came out a while ago. It didn't do that well in the box office, but it was nevertheless a very heartfelt film, and Hillary Swank is a wonderful actress, and she spent a lot of time and energy working on this film. And basically, she portrayed this heroic woman, Betty Ann Waters, who is held responsible in the film and in real life for freeing her brother, Kenneth Waters, from prison after about 20 years for a crime that, if you watch the movie, you'd think it was a crime he did not commit. Now, you got to give credit to Betty Ann. She was a high school dropout who, because she was so dedicated to her brother, got her GED, went to college, and ultimately went to law school, passed the bar exam, all so that she could work on his case and file motions for new trial and get new DNA tests on old evidence. And you got to give her kudos. No matter what you think of her, we should all be so lucky to have siblings who love us that much. And I don't mean to take anything away from that, but there was a ton of evidence against Kenneth Waters. And if you watch the movie Conviction, you'd never know it. You would not realize the strength of the case against him, because the way the Hollywood... And I feel bad for Hillary Swank, because I think she's a person with integrity, who I think should care that she was in a film that was disrespectful to victims, that falsely suggested the guy had nothing to do with the crime. And let me tell you, in a nutshell, the sort of most important facts that aren't in the film that suggest he was involved and that really support his conviction, notwithstanding what DNA tests showed many years later. In other words, DNA 20 years later doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the crime. It certainly doesn't tell you the whole truth, and in many, many cases, it can be nothing but a distraction from the truth. And I think the Innocence Project, frankly, has done a great disservice to the public by suggesting otherwise. Most of the Innocence Project cases, where they claim over 250 men at this point have been cleared, exonerated, rendered innocent by new DNA tests, the fact is the vast majority of them are guilty, and they have had their convictions overturned, but they nevertheless are factually guilty of the crimes for which they were convicted. And I think the public is entitled to the truth. Even if the guys get out, the public is entitled to the truth. So in Conviction, a few facts the public doesn't realize. There was the woman who was killed lived close by to Ken Waters. I mean, you could see there, they lived in a trailer park. They could see each other's homes. She was older. She knew Kenneth Waters because she was a frequent guest at his diner, at the diner where he worked. And, you know, she told people that she had money she was saving in her purse. She was saving it for a trip to Germany. She had money in her trailer park that she was keeping in her bed that she was saving, again, for this trip, a couple thousand dollars. Kenneth Waters said to his girlfriend, you know, a week or so before the crime, that German lady who comes in all the time, she's got a lot of cash on her. She's got cash in her trailer. I want that money. The day that she was found dead, she was brutally stabbed to death, repeatedly stabbed to death, and beaten with a lamp and a toaster. So she was both stabbed and beaten. I think she was stabbed like 30 times. Mm-hmm. The murder weapon was found in her trailer in a wastebasket, and it was a weapon that was tied to Kenneth Waters, and was a weapon that reportedly he had used at a former job that was missing from his job, and it was connected to him. And that was never really undermined at all. But, by the way, it wasn't really mentioned even in the film Conviction. It's true that the DNA tests that were done 20 years later showed blood from a different man mixed with the victim's blood. But, you know, the prosecutor said there was probably another guy with him, because while he's stabbing, the other guy's hitting her over the head with a lamp, perhaps Kenneth Waters nicked the other guy with his knife. You know, it makes sense. It was only a tiny bit of male DNA from another man, unidentified so far, found at the scene. It makes sense that if Kenneth is stabbing her and the other guy's hitting her with a lamp, you know, maybe he nicked the guy and some of his blood landed at the crime scene as well. I think what people don't understand is, and this is the most critical part, he confessed to a girlfriend repeatedly. And when she confronted him specifically, and they left town, and he said, you know, well, if the cops come over and ask us questions, tell them I'm not home. And by the way, we got to leave town. When she said to him after they did leave town and moved to Rhode Island from Massachusetts, did you kill that lady in Ayer? He said, yeah, what's it to you? Who cares? And she left him. She literally left him and moved back to Massachusetts. He then told another woman, I killed that German bitch. And, you know, I stabbed her. I stabbed that German bitch. There was just so much evidence against this guy, and the idea that because someone else's DNA was found mixed in with her blood, somehow undoes that boatload of evidence against him is absurdity. Despite the nice Hollywood story about the sister who worked so hard to get the DNA test done, and, you know, it's good that she did that. And I'm not even necessarily opposed to the idea that he should have had a new trial, because the evolution of DNA science provided this new information. And, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't, in 1980 or in the early 80s when this was all going to trial, there was no DNA technology. So I don't even mind that 20 years later the new tests are done and maybe they should give the guy a new trial. But, you know, that's not what happened. They reversed his conviction, and then he won $3.5 million in a lawsuit.
Yeah.
In a lawsuit. You can't persuade me that it's good for society that a person who gets his conviction reversed, but where there's still a lot of evidence against him, should recover such a huge pile of cash. Among other things, it incentivizes real killers and real rapists to try to get their convictions reversed so that they can win a pile of money too. And then the public thinks these guys are all innocent when they could be super dangerous. There are lots of Innocence Project cases where the guys got their convictions reversed based on new DNA tests, and then they went out and raped children again.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm fondly, you know, of the, I'm fond of the idea that we should be fighting for the release of the truly innocent, and that the truly factually innocent should get money from the state for being wrongfully convicted, wrongfully held behind bars. I have no problem with that. I pay my own money to do that. But to give money to people who are factually guilty, to make movies out of cases where there's so much evidence in support of guilt, and it's not even in the movie, and then you're sort of tricking the public into believing this fantasy. And who does that serve? What public good is served by a Hollywood movie that so distorts the truth, disrespects the victims, saps public resources? I don't get it. I just don't understand who could have thought that making that movie was a good idea. All I can say is I hope the reason the movie bombed is because a lot of people knew the truth and refused to buy the ticket.
Well, it could be, but check out Wendy's op-ed on that tomorrow at patriotledger.com. Wendy, as always, a pleasure. Thank you, ma'am.
My pleasure, too. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy, former sex crimes prosecutor, and we're going to have another former sex crimes prosecutor on with us in just a minute with Robin Sachs. Stay tuned. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Anyway, I think this is the world famous Robin Sachs. I phoned.
Hello,
I'm here.
I want you to know I have two phones. This one is the one that is not doing well.
Yeah.
But none of them have been ringing for me, Mr. Pretzer.
Well, I've been phoning for the last 5 minutes, and they ring and ring and ring and ring and ring, and there's no answer. So I don't know. Something's weird. Anyway, Robin Sachs is here. You know her as a former DA. She's a current attorney, author, TV analyst, and rumored to be Charlie Sheen's replacement on Two and a Half Men, with the show title going to be changed, One and a Half Men and a Real Hot Ex-DA. Is that true? Is that true or no, listen.
No, it is not true. I'm so enthralled with what Charlie Sheen has been saying all over national television that I can't get into production on my own show right now because I'm so busy listening to the crap that's coming out of his mouth.
Well, he's nuts. I'm sorry, but I'm saying this. The guy obviously has an alleged addiction problem. He's got everything else, but to hear him rambling right now, I would bet my next paycheck, which isn't all that big, certainly not as big as Charlie Sheen's. I'd have to work all my life, and not even that, to get one day's work out of what he gets paid. That guy's got some mental health problems. What do you think?
I think the guy's got a lot of problems, and I feel really bad in that, and I say bad in a loose sense of the word, because, you know, he is his own train wreck. At some point, you've got to wonder at what point is there free will involved, and is there another point where it's just sickness, drugs, chemicals, everything all mixed into one causing an unbelievable downward spiral. And it's a little bit confusing to figure out what it exactly is, because what's hard from us as the public is here is someone who is very talented, or at least seemingly talented by, at least, certainly if you look at number of fans, and he's got a very highly successful show, yet he commits career suicide. He's now delved in the depths of anti-Semitism and hit those chords, which are never good chords to hit in Hollywood, combined with domestic violence. But yet, maybe, just maybe, we're finally getting a break for Lindsay Lohan here, who deserves a break when compared to Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, even Charlie has got a phone call of best wishes from Mel Gibson. When I heard that, I just about spit the coffee out that I was drinking. But what about the media, Robin? Robin Sachs is here. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com. What about the media? Is this really that big a story? It's not, but, you know, people still want to hear about this train wreck. And why are people so concerned about these Hollywood train wrecks? And Sheen has gone off the tracks. You know, I haven't spent 2.5 minutes watching Two and a Half Men. I don't find Charlie Sheen all that great of an actor, to be quite honest with you. He obviously, the show gets great ratings and does all the sort of stuff. But why is the public and why are the networks so enthralled with this guy and letting him come on the air and babble the way he's been babbling?
Well, first of all, I think whenever you look at a case that's in the news, you must not look at it just for the case that it is, but you must look at it with the lens of what else is going on. So let's look at what's going on in the world of celebrity pop culture, celebrity justice, and what are the cases. Right now we're dealing basically in celebrity news with three big cases. You've got this decision in the Mel Gibson case, you've got the Lindsay Lohan stuff, and you've got this Charlie Sheen stuff. The fact of the matter is that Charlie Sheen is getting a lot of airplay here right now because his ratings are so high. So if his ratings are so high on Two and a Half Men, certainly the real-life train wreck should have similar, if not better, type of ratings. So if you're in the business of getting ratings and you're in the business of satiating the public, Sheen is what sells. And again, if you're going to compare it to Lindsay Lohan and Mel Gibson, really there's nothing going on of any news in that case. The only thing in town when it comes to pop culture, celebrity pop culture, is Charlie Sheen. So you can't escape the fact that there's not much other news, which is why this is becoming more newsy than ever before. The fact of the matter is also we all love a train wreck, and also we also, as a society, are very enthralled with criminal justice and what's going on with all of our other criminal justice cases. Well, we've got the Dugard, where, you know, we have confessions in that case, and the Garridos have made complete confessions, and while that feels satisfying, it's not exactly, it's somewhat anticlimactic. So, the only thing that you can do is follow the train wreck, and that's Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan, Mel Gibson, and Dr. Conrad Murray for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, for sure. Robin Sachs is here. Tell us, what have you been up to?
Well, I have been fighting all kinds of fights. I have a very fascinating case of a sexual assault case going on in Florida right now that I'm right now somewhat under wraps. That won't be for much longer, but it's about dealing with the fact that a teacher was the one who was admitted back to the school, though had been the one who had been suspected of child sexual abuse, and the kid who had actually reported had been dismissed. There's been some fascinating other cases going on with the that I've learned about the coroner's department here in Los Angeles, about some unbelievable atrocities that you wouldn't believe what's going on. So I've got my nose in all kinds of cases, always seeking justice and always stopping by to visit you, Dana.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs. Check her out at robinsachs.com. Always a pleasure, ma'am.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's former DA Robin Sachs, and she's doing attorney work and TV work and book work, and she does lots. She's very busy. And again, Red's busy listening to the show tonight. He says Sheen's not nuts. He's just high on Charlie Sheen, that and probably several other things. How happy is Emilio Estevez that he changed his name? Yeah, I'll bet. That's for sure. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you can listen to the show live, pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, etc., etc. And for all that blog information that you want to hear about, check out scaredmonkeys.com and check out the forum at scaredmonkeys.net. There's all sorts of information there. We're here for you. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.